Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, to ask a question, please press star one. Also, this call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'd like to turn the meeting over to Ms. Alicia Downs. You may begin.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for today's COCA conference call entitled Epidemiology and Management of MRSA in the Community. We are very pleased to have Dr. Rachel Gorwitz present on this very timely topic. Dr. Gorwitz will be using a PowerPoint presentation for this call, and you should be able to access that at our website. If you have not already downloaded this presentation, please go to www.emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. Click on the conference call information summaries and slide sets. The PowerPoint can be found with the MRSA call information. Our speaker, Dr. Rachel Gorwitz, has been a medical epidemiologist with the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention since 2004, where she serves as a subject matter expert on community-associated methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. Dr. Gorwitz is the lead author of the CDC's guidance for clinical management of MRSA in the community, and she has authored or co-authored numerous other publications on CAMRSA. Today's objectives: after the presentation, the participant should be able to discuss the epidemiology of MRSA in the community, describe strategies for the clinical management of skin infections in the era of community-associated MRSA, and describe appropriate measures for patients to protect themselves from infection and limit the spread of MRSA. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Gorwitz.
Thank you. Hello, and thank you for taking the time to join us today. Today I'm going to be providing some information that I hope will be useful to you both in treating your sick patients and also talking to your worried well patients about the meaning of everything they've been hearing recently in the news about MRSA and what they can do to protect themselves. I'm going to be talking initially a little bit about the epidemiology of MRSA, and then I'll move on to issues related to clinical management, particularly of skin infections. Next slide. So as you probably know, Staph aureus has been a common human colonizer and pathogen really throughout history. It's a common cause of infection in the community, particularly skin infections, and about 30% of people carry Staph aureus in their nose at any given time. Methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, is really a form of Staph aureus that's resistant to all currently available beta-lactam antibiotics, which includes all penicillins and cephalosporins. And MRSA has been an increasingly important cause of healthcare-associated infections in the United States since around the 1970s. But until more recently, it was rarely seen outside of patients in the hospital or patients with significant healthcare exposure. However, in the 1990s, MRSA emerged as a cause of infection in otherwise healthy people in the general community. And these are new strains of MRSA that are distinct from those that were already established in healthcare. And for reasons unrelated to their antimicrobial resistance, these new strains may actually be contributing to an increase in the overall burden of Staph disease in the community, and in some cases more severe disease. But fortunately, skin infections continue to account for the majority of this disease. Next slide. Initially, as I said, the strains of MRSA isolated from patients with community-associated MRSA were distinct from those that acquired MRSA in healthcare hospital settings. They were both genetically and phenotypically distinct. And this suggests that they did not escape from hospitals, but likely descended from methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus strains that were already established in the community. And specifically, the prevalent genotypes are different for healthcare, MRSA in healthcare and MRSA in the community. in the United States, in healthcare settings. Pulse field types, USA 100 and USA 200 are most common, whereas in the community, it's pulse field types USA 300 and USA 400. In terms of antimicrobial resistance, MRSA in healthcare tends to be resistant to multiple classes of antimicrobial agents in addition to the beta-lactams, and often only susceptible to vancomycin and some newer agents, whereas MRSA in the community setting often is resistant only to the beta-lactam agents. There are also differences in the SCC-MEC, which is the genetic element that carries the MECA resistance gene. MRSA in healthcare tends most commonly to carry type 2 SCC-MEC. In the community, it's most commonly SCC-MEC 4. And there are also differences in the prevalence of genes for various toxins, such as the Panthon-Valentine leukocytin or PVL toxin. And these genes are rarely found in MRSA in healthcare setting and commonly found in strains circulating in the community. But having said that, the lines of distinction are blurring between MRSA in healthcare and the community. We've seen MRSA strains that were first recognized in the community moving into and being transmitted in healthcare settings. And also, as community strains acquire more resistance, they become less phenotypically distinct from the healthcare strains. Over time, of course, the same strains could become predominant in both settings. Next slide. The CDC has established a national database of MRSA pulse field types. The four pulse field types that are in the yellow boxes are those that are historically community associated, meaning that these pulse field types were initially associated predominantly with community settings, although as I've said, that may be changing as some of these move into healthcare settings. Next slide. However, even though there are several pulse field types that could be considered historically community-associated, a single pulse field type, which is USA 300, has accounted for most community-associated MRSA infections in the United States. And in fact, a single indistinguishable strain has been responsible for infections and outbreaks in various settings across the country that are not directly linked to one another, which demonstrates the potential for rapid spread, particularly of this strain. Next slide. The term community-associated MRSA in general refers to MRSA infections with onset in the community in persons that lack risk factors which would suggest they encountered and became colonized with MRSA initially in a healthcare setting. And for the purposes of CDC-sponsored population-based surveillance, such as that was reported recently in the JAMA article, the specific definition of community-associated MRSA is a patient with signs and symptoms of infection in which the MRSA culture was obtained in an outpatient setting or the first 48 hours of hospitalization, and the patient lacks risk factors for healthcare-associated MRSA, including all those listed. Now, for the purposes of clinical management of patients, you don't need to formally categorize your patients into these categories of healthcare and community-associated MRSA. Next slide. Outbreaks of MRSA in the community are often first detected as clusters of skin infections, abscesses, or what are initially mistaken for spider bites, even in areas of the country where spiders capable of causing necrotic skin lesions are not endemic. And outbreaks have been described in a variety of settings that are listed on your slide. Next slide. To elaborate a little bit more on the issue of confusion with spider bites, we're not sure exactly why this occurs. On the part of patients, it may be because they see the sudden appearance of a painful red bump and they assume that they've been bitten by an insect or spider. On the part of clinicians, it may be because many of these lesions will have necrotic appearing areas that clinicians may associate with spider bites. However, as this diagram shows, spiders capable of causing necrotic skin lesions are not endemic in most areas of the country. And even in areas of the country where these spiders do occur, necrotic lesions from these spider bites are probably much less common than staph and MRSA skin infections. So if a patient is coming in with a complaint of a spider bite, certainly worthwhile to consider staph aureus and to obtain a culture. Next slide. The types of skin lesions caused by staph aureus and MRSA are typically described as furuncles or boils or abscesses. They can be single or multiple. But many times they may be severe, and the deeper lesions frequently require hospital admission and treatment with IV antibiotics. Sometimes these infections can be recurrent. We don't have good data on how common this is. But it may be up to 10 to 20% or more of patients may experience recurrent infections. We know, of course, that recurrent furunculosis is something that has been described with staph aureus in general in the past, but there's a sense that perhaps these recurrent infections are occurring more commonly with these new strains of MRSA. And then I didn't include a picture here, but one form of MRSA skin infections that we see in newborns is a pustulosis of the diaper area that could be confused with other newborn rashes. And in general, these aren't severe. In some cases, they've been treated solely with topical therapy. But because of the very young age of the patients, these patients will sometimes be admitted and treated with IV antibiotics. Next slide. There are a number of factors that facilitate transmission of MRSA in some settings. One of these factors is crowding or crowded living conditions, and this is an image of a military barracks. Next slide. Another factor is frequent skin-to-skin contact such that occurs in certain sports such as football. Next slide. Another factor is the presence of compromised skin surfaces, which allows an easy portal of entry for the bacteria. And this is an image of turf burns in football players. And many times in football players, these infections have occurred at the site of turf burns. Next slide. Sharing of potentially contaminated items or surfaces. This is an image of a football player with a towel. Frequently in outbreaks among football players, there was sharing of towels between players during the game. The use of saunas has also been implicated in transmission in a couple of outbreaks. However, it's difficult to tease out the specific role of the environment in those settings because many people tended to use the sauna at one time, so there also could have been a role of direct skin-to-skin contact. Next slide. Another factor is barriers to maintaining good personal hygiene and cleanliness. For example, in some correctional facility settings, access to soap may be limited due to concern about using the products or the dispensers as weapons. Next slide. And some studies have identified prior antibiotic use as a risk factor, while others have not. And it may depend on the specific agent and duration of exposure. It's not a common occurrence for new strains of MRSA to be born, so to speak, meaning that a susceptible staph strain acquires the resistant genes for methicillin resistance. However, antibiotic exposure might facilitate acquisition of a resistant organism by decreasing the numbers of other normal flora. Next slide. The study that's received so much attention in the past week was based on multi-state population-based surveillance, specifically for invasive MRSA infections. An earlier study using a subset of these sites included surveillance for all culture-confirmed MRSA infections. Next slide. The next couple of slides are based on that earlier study that looked at all culture-confirmed MRSA infections. And we found that the majority of these culture-confirmed MRSA infections are skin infections, almost 80%, whereas only about 6% were invasive, meaning the isolate was obtained from a normally sterile site. Next slide. Again, looking at all culture-confirmed community-associated MRSA infections, in that earlier study, the incidence varied by age and race, with the infections being more common in blacks as compared to whites, and the incidence being highest in children less than 2 years of age. And I'll reiterate, this was talking about all culture-confirmed community-associated MRSA infections. Next slide. Moving on to the current study that dealt only with invasive MRSA infections, a key point of that recent article that seems to have been overlooked, I think, in a lot of the media reports, was that the majority of these invasive MRSA infections are still healthcare associated. About 14% of the invasive MRSA infections were community associated. Next slide. And looking specifically at the incidence of invasive community-associated MRSA infections and deaths by age, the incidence of these infections was highest in the elderly and lowest in toddlers and school-age children. And mortality from these infections was low in all age groups, but particularly among children. Of course, we know that deaths do occur even in children and are, you know, clearly very alarming and tragic when they do occur, but fortunately these are quite rare. Next slide. Because cultures are often not obtained from skin infections, we know less about the burden of staphylococcal and MRSA skin infections. However, from information based on outpatient visits, we know that in 2001 through 2003, there were almost 12 million ambulatory care visits per year for skin infections typical of Staph aureus. And between the early 1990s and the early 2000s, there was an increase in these outpatient visits, specifically to emergency departments and hospital outpatient departments. And this is perhaps as a result of the emergence of these new MRSA strains. Next slide. In many parts of the country, the majority of these skin infections are now due to MRSA. And this is from a study done by a group called the Emergency IDNet. This study was done in August 2004 and looked at all adult patients presenting to these emergency departments with purulent skin infections. And the proportion of those infections from which MRSA was isolated ranged from 15% to 74%, but overall almost 60% of these infections were caused by MRSA, and virtually all of those MRSA infections were USA 300. Next slide. Shifting now to look at colonization, this graph is from a nationally representative study of nasal colonization in the U.S. that shows while about 30% of Americans carry Staph aureus in general in their nose, less than 1% carry MRSA. And this is, of course, in contrast to the previous slide I showed you, which showed the large proportion of all the Staph aureus infections in the community caused by MRSA. And this discrepancy suggests that the MRSA strains that have emerged may be more likely to cause infection. There are some other data that suggest this as well. And it's also been proposed that these strains may be more likely to colonize body sites other than the nose. However, this hasn't been systematically evaluated. Next slide. While lack of resistance to multiple classes of antimicrobial agents has really been one of the defining characteristics of MRSA in the community, that may be changing over time. And this slide shows data from the Texas Children's Hospital, and it looks at the prevalence of clindamycin resistance in MRSA isolates from pediatric patients with community-associated MRSA infections in the blue bars and community-onset MRSA infections in children that had healthcare risk factors in the yellow bars. And in both of these groups, the majority of these MRSA infections, again, were USA 300. And in both groups, but particularly among the children with healthcare risk factors, the prevalence of clindamycin resistance increased over this three-year period. Next slide. Well, we've also now have some information on emerging multiple drug resistance in USA 300. Specifically, there have been clusters of USA 300 isolates with multiple resistance to erythromycin, clindamycin, tetracycline, ciprofloxacin, and the topical agent mupirocin. And these have been described among men who have sex with men in Boston and San Francisco. Fortunately, however, resistance to less than or equal to one class of antibiotics other than beta-lactams is still the most common resistance pattern in MRSA USA 300. And resistance to trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole is rare in MRSA USA 300. Next slide. As I mentioned earlier, we've now seen entry of some of these, you know, what we consider community pulse field types into hospital settings, and these are data from Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, looking at their MRSA isolates from nosocomial bloodstream infections, and they found that 20% of these were USA 300. So the implications of the movement of these new strains into healthcare settings are unclear. There is a concern that this could result in even increased morbidity and mortality from healthcare-associated MRSA. Next slide. So now I'd like to go on to discussing strategies for clinical management of MRSA in the community. And most of what I'm going to be saying summarizes guidance based on input from clinical and public health MRSA experts in a document that's available on our website. The contents of this document has also been used to develop a one-page treatment algorithm for skin and soft tissue infections in conjunction with the American Medical Association and the Infectious Disease Society of America. And I believe that that algorithm is going to be posted on our website later on today. Next slide. Well, clinicians are well aware that Staph aureus is a common cause particularly of skin infections in the community. And, you know, what you need to know now is that MRSA belongs in the differential diagnosis of skin and soft tissue infections that are typical of Staph aureus. This includes, as I mentioned, abscesses and pustular lesions that are commonly confused with spider bites. The role of MRSA in pure cellulitis, meaning cellulitis without any discrete collection of pus, is less clear because cultures are less often obtained. And, of course, we know that group A strep is also an important pathogen in cellulitis. Next slide. MRSA should also be considered in the differential diagnosis of severe disease compatible with Staph aureus infection, including all of these syndromes listed on this slide. In terms of osteomyelitis, we know that Staph aureus has been one of the most common causes of osteomyelitis in the community. There's some data to suggest that concurrent with the emergence of these new MRSA strains, more of these cases may be complicated by venous thrombosis and septic pulmonary emboli. There's some evidence to suggest that Staph aureus, and in particular MRSA, is replacing pneumococcus as the most common cause of empyema in children following the introduction of the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine in 2000. And we know that Staph aureus has been recognized as a rare cause of community-acquired pneumonia, especially influenza-associated pneumonia. But when these infections do occur, they're often severe with a high case fatality rate. And now we are seeing these cases of severe necrotizing pneumonia caused by MRSA as well. However, it's unclear whether this is adding to the total burden of Staph aureus community-acquired pneumonia or whether MRSA is simply replacing methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus. There are also reports of cases of sepsis syndrome due to MRSA. These are described as being very similar in presentation to toxic shock syndrome, but without fulfilling the complete criteria. And then recently we've seen reports of MRSA being identified as the cause of some syndromes that had rarely been described in association with Staph aureus in the past, such as necrotizing fasciitis, which has more commonly been associated with group A strep, and purpura fulminans, which is more commonly associated with meningococcus. Next slide. So what are the important components of management of skin infections in the era of community-associated MRSA? Well, incision and drainage has been and continues to be the primary therapy for purulent skin lesions, such as abscesses. And in some cases, incision and drainage alone may be adequate treatment. Next slide. Although it hasn't been standard practice in the past, we're encouraging clinicians to obtain cultures from patients with skin infections, particularly those with more severe infections and when you plan to initiate antibiotic therapy. And this should be done, of course, primarily to inform your management of that individual patient, but it also does contribute to a knowledge of your local epidemiology of Staph aureus in terms of the prevalence of MRSA and the prevalence of resistance to other agents. Next slide. There are no data to suggest that molecular typing or toxin testing should guide clinical management, so these do not need to be performed routinely. There's not a particular strain or strain characteristic that's associated with progression to more severe disease, and so your management should be determined based on clinical presentation. Next slide. As I said, in some cases, incision and drainage alone may be adequate therapy for these skin infections. However, in some of the cases, empiric antimicrobial therapy may also be used. The decision of whether to provide antimicrobial therapy is obviously a clinical judgment. There are no good evidence-based criteria. However, some considerations to take into account would be the presence of systemic symptoms such as fever, the presence of more severe local disease and surrounding cellulitis, the presence of underlying illness or other conditions, extremes of patient age, and of course failure to respond adequately to incision and drainage alone. Next slide. When antibiotics are needed based on your clinical judgment, there are a number of options available for these MRSA strains in the community, including agents that can be given orally. And I will talk more about that a little bit later. Next slide. Because the prevalence of MRSA still does vary geographically, as well as the prevalence of resistance to other classes of agents that you might consider using for MRSA coverage, it's important to know your local data when you're deciding on empiric therapy for skin infections. Next slide. And one critical component of case management for patients with skin infections is educating your patients on what they can do to limit further transmission. And I'm going to address that more specifically later as well. Next slide. And because we know that a small proportion of these infections may progress to more severe and invasive disease, it's important to maintain adequate follow-up. Ideally, this would involve scheduling a follow-up visit, but at minimum, it's important to make sure your patient knows what signs and symptoms they should be looking for that should motivate them to return. Next slide. There are a number of agents, as I said, that may be used that are typically active against the MRSA strain circulating in the community, and those are listed on this slide. We need more data from controlled clinical trials to establish the effectiveness of any of these agents. Fortunately, the NIH has recently funded a clinical trial looking at treatment of MRSA skin infections. So we will have more information on that within the next several years. However, a number of agents have been and are being used. Each of them has advantages and disadvantages. Clindamycin, for example, has a potential for inducible resistance, and I will talk about that in a subsequent slide. Clindamycin may be associated with a relatively higher risk of C. diff-associated disease. Of course, this can occur in association with any antibiotic agent. And it's still quite rare, particularly in children, for whom the list of available agents is shorter. Trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole and tetracyclines, neither of these are known to have good activity against group A strep, which is a consideration if you are also wanting to provide coverage for group A strep. Tetracyclines are not recommended for children less than 8 years old. Rifampin has sometimes been used in combination with some of the other agents. There really are no data on whether this provides any additional benefit. However, rifampin definitely should not be used as a single agent due to the potential for resistance to develop rapidly. Linezolid is a newer agent, more expensive than the other agents. And one that we would like to see reserved for use in patients that truly need it. We are recommending that the use of linezolid be done in consultation with an infectious disease specialist. Next slide. There are some agents that are not optimal for treatment of skin infections when you want to provide coverage for MRSA. And this is because of a high prevalence of resistance or potential for rapid development of resistance. And this includes macrolides and fluoroquinolones. Next slide. So getting back now to the issue of inducible clindamycin resistance. This is a phenomenon in which isolates that appear susceptible on routine testing can readily be induced to express resistance to clindamycin. And in the laboratory, erythromycin is used to induce this resistance. And that's demonstrated in the figure on this slide, which shows a lawn of the bacterial isolate with disks of erythromycin on the left and clindamycin on the right. And you can see there's a clearing of the field of bacteria around the clindamycin disc, showing that the isolate is susceptible to clindamycin. However, on that side of the zone of inhibition closest to the erythromycin disc, you can see that there's flattening of the zone of inhibition so that the zone looks like a letter D, and that's why this test is called the D-zone test. But what I'd like to point out is that although erythromycin is used to induce this resistance in a laboratory setting, pre- or co-treatment with erythromycin is not necessary for this to occur in a patient. Now, the clinical implications of a positive D-zone test are unclear. Clindamycin treatment failures have occurred in patients infected with inducibly resistant strains, particularly patients with invasive infections. If you know that a patient is infected with an inducibly resistant isolate, clearly you wouldn't want to initiate treatment with clindamycin. If you've empirically started clindamycin and you find out that there's a positive D-zone test, the isolate has inducible resistance, it's obviously you want to follow up with a patient and assess their response to therapy. If they're responding adequately to therapy, it would be reasonable to continue that course of clindamycin. Next slide. The management of more severe and invasive infections was not discussed in detail at our experts meeting that we held to develop this guidance. What I will say is that vancomycin remains a first-line therapy for severe infections possibly caused by MRSA. Other IV agents may be appropriate, and certainly it makes sense to consult an infectious disease specialist. Final therapy decisions, of course, should be based on the results of culture and susceptibility testing. And then I also wanted to direct your attention to new guidance put out by the Infectious Disease Society of America and the American Thoracic Society on treatment of community-acquired pneumonia in adults that came out in 2007, in which they recommend the use of vancomycin or linezolid if MRSA is a consideration in severe community-acquired pneumonia. Next slide. Well, what is the role of screening and decolonization? In general, colonization cultures of infected or exposed persons in community settings are not recommended. These cultures may have a role, for example, in public health investigations, in which it may provide information that's useful to control the outbreak. Another reason you might screen persons for colonization is in order to target some sort of intervention. And in hospitals, for example, colonization screening is sometimes done in order to identify patients that should be placed on contact precautions and therefore limit transmission in the facility. Now that, of course, isn't something that's applicable in the community setting. But another intervention is decolonization, which is the use of topical and or systemic antimicrobial agents and antiseptic agents with the intent of eliminating colonization. Again, these regimens, there's some data to suggest that they may be effective in preventing infections in some healthcare settings, but more data are needed to establish their efficacy and to establish the optimal regimens for use in community settings. And we know, as I mentioned earlier, that resistance to some of the agents, such as mupirocin, which is a topical agent that is often used intranasally to eliminate colonization, we know that resistance has developed. So, of course, we want to limit the use of these agents to the circumstances where they are necessary and likely to be effective. So controlled trials are currently underway looking at the use of these regimens in community settings. But our current guidance is to consider these regimens after treating active infections and reinforcing hygiene and appropriate wound care when you have an individual patient that's having recurrent infections, or you're seeing recurrent infections among members of a defined setting such as a household. Next slide. What advice can you give your patients regarding prevention? Well, persons with skin infections should keep their wounds covered, wash their hands frequently and certainly always after touching infected skin or changing wound dressings. They should dispose of used bandages in the trash and avoid sharing personal items that could have come in contact with infected skin. Uninfected persons can minimize their risk of infection by keeping cuts and scrapes clean and covered, avoiding contact with other persons' infected skin, washing their hands frequently, and again, avoiding sharing of personal items. Next slide. Exclusion of patients from school, work, sports activities, and so forth should be reserved for those that are unable to keep their infected skin covered with a clean, dry bandage and to maintain good personal hygiene. Now, in some settings, such as public swimming pools, it really would be impossible for someone to keep a skin infection covered while they're in a swimming pool, so we recommend that persons with active skin infections not use a public water facility or swimming pool. In general, it's not necessary to close schools to disinfect or decontaminate them when MRSA infections occur. This is because, you know, most transmission is from direct skin-to-skin contact, so it's most important to reinforce the strategies that I just described about wound containment. And really, covering wounds will go a long way to limiting environmental contamination in the first place. Now, having said that, environmental cleaning is important, but should focus on surfaces likely to have come in contact with wound drainage. And these surfaces can be cleaned with any commercially available detergent or disinfectant, so there's not a need for any specialized decontamination measures. Again, though, I would like to point out that decisions about closing schools and so forth should be made by school officials in conjunction with their local health departments. Now, in ambulatory care settings, in terms of infection control, you should be using standard precautions for all patients. This includes hand hygiene before and after contact with the patient, using barriers such as gloves and gowns as appropriate for anticipated contact with wound drainage and other body fluids. Next slide. I just wanted to say a little bit of something about the role of pets, since this is a question that comes up frequently. What is the role of pets in community-associated MRSA? Well, the greatest risk of Staph aureus and MRSA exposure in most humans is other humans. Humans are more likely to carry Staph aureus and MRSA than other animals, particularly pet animals. When household pet animals carry MRSA, they likely acquired it initially from a human. However, transmission of MRSA from an infected or colonized pet to a human is possible, but this likely accounts for a very small proportion of human infections. Having said that, there have been case reports of ongoing transmission in households that were potentially linked to a colonized pet. Therefore, it's reasonable to consider a pet as a source if transmission is continuing in a household, despite optimizing other control strategies. However, there's little evidence that antimicrobial-based eradication therapy or decolonization is effective in pets. However, fortunately, colonization tends to be short-term in these animals. And so if you're in a circumstance where you're having recurrent infections in a household and you've decided to provide decolonization to the household members, and also have identified a pet as colonized, it may be appropriate to limit contact between the humans and that pet until the decolonization therapy has been completed. Next slide. And so in conclusion, new strains of MRSA have emerged in the community with implications for management of skin infections and other staphylococcal infections. Incision and drainage remains a primary therapy for purulent skin infections. Oral treatment options are available for patients with skin infections that require ancillary antibiotic therapy. Patient education on proper wound care is a critical component of case management for patients with skin infections. And finally, strategies focusing on increased awareness, early detection and appropriate management, enhanced hygiene, and maintenance of a clean environment have been successful in controlling clusters and outbreaks of infection. Next slide. This is just an example of some materials that are available on our website, some posters that you could put up, for example, in your office, reminding patients about washing their hands, not sharing personal items, and so forth. I will also mention that we're in the process of developing a national public health information campaign sponsored by the CDC Foundation with materials for the public, patients, and healthcare providers. There are also many excellent materials developed by state and local health departments and other sources as well. Just a couple of examples that come to mind are Los Angeles County and Tacoma, Pierce County, Washington, and we've started to provide links to some of these other materials on our website as well. Next slide. Just wanted to acknowledge all of the experts that contributed to the development of our guidance. Next slide. And now I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Thank you. At this time, we are ready to begin the question and answer session. Please unmute your line and record your name when prompted. Please press star 1 to do so. Your name is required to introduce your question. Once again, that is star 1 to ask a question. And to withdraw your question, you may press star 2. One moment, please. Our first question comes from Monty Ataveros. Your line is open.
Yes, ma'am. My question is, since we are located in South Texas and we're Medical Reserve Corps, do you have any numbers from the Mexican side on their MRSA infections?
Thank you for that question. We do not have any data on community-associated MRSA in Mexico. I did recently attend a conference on community-associated MRSA in South America along with a colleague from Mexico who indicated that they have not been seeing much community-associated MRSA thus far in Mexico, but we do not have any specific statistics.
Numbers on that. Thank you very much.
Our next question comes from Tracy Peck. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm a family nurse practitioner in Sioux City, Iowa, and I work in occupational medicine and then I do college health also. My question is actually several parts. First of all, with MRSA, I had a patient who was evaluated in the emergency room, sustained a laceration at work and had a suture repair done. He then returned with redness and purulence and swelling, and so they did culture it, and it was MRSA positive. So the company asked if we felt this was a work-related problem or if it was not work-related. Without any typing, is there any way that we could say whether or not the infection occurred from home versus the hospital?
Okay. So thanks for that question. As I mentioned in my talk, really it's a single pulse field type, and even within that, a single strain that has accounted for the majority of these community-associated skin infections. So even if you were to do some type of typing, you know, comparing to, I don't know if there were other infections in the work setting, I mean, I don't think it would be very informative. It would be very difficult to determine where that person initially encountered MRSA.
Okay. And is MRSA a reportable disease?
So public health reporting laws are determined by individual states. And I believe that currently about a third to a half of the states have MRSA, some forms of MRSA reportable. Oftentimes it's not all MRSA infections, and you know, the numbers of MRSA infections are much larger in comparison to other reportable conditions and really would place quite a burden on those responsible for reporting. But certainly, I mean, CDC feels one of our roles is to support states in making sure that if they've made this condition reportable, to making sure that the information they collect is useful. I will also add that there are other ways to monitor and track the burden of these infections other than making the infection reportable, that in some cases could provide even more complete and useful information. And one example is the recent JAMA article, this multi-state population-based surveillance system that gave us such, you know, complete information on the burden of infection in those communities.
And who is responsible for the reporting? Is the lab responsible, or is the...
So again, I mean, that would vary. As I said, the laws are determined by individual states, and so the individual state law would indicate who is responsible. In some cases, it may be the laboratory. In some cases, it may be the clinician, and in some cases, it may be both.
Okay. Thank you. Our next question comes from Donna Flint. Your line is open.
Thank you. Are you finding that the nasal colonization with the community-associated strain is similar to that of the old-fashioned hospital one?
Okay, thank you for that question. You know, as I mentioned, in general, nasal colonization with MRSA in the U.S. population is still uncommon, in the neighborhood of 1%. Most of those people that are carrying MRSA in their noses are actually not carrying what we consider, you know, the community strain, such as the USA 300, although that may be changing over time. As I mentioned, there's been some suggestion that perhaps these new strains, such as USA 300, may be less likely to colonize the nose and more likely to colonize other body sites. I'm not aware of really any studies that have addressed that directly, with the exception of one study I know that was done in Canada that looked at newborns during a cluster or outbreak of MRSA USA 300, and they swabbed the noses, the umbilicus, and I believe perirectal, and the nose was still the most commonly identified site of MRSA USA 300 colonization.
One of our infectious disease physicians is finding in his clinic setting, particularly when it's been transmitted to other family members and it's been difficult to get rid of it, that the rectal swabs are more often positive than the nasal are.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I think I agree. This is something that we need to learn more about, and you know, we're in the process of hopefully developing a study where we can look at comparison of colonization at different body sites.
Well, and that would be very helpful, especially when many places are going to surveillance cultures, you know, which is nasal for hospital admissions, and as this community-associated strain becomes more prevalent, we may be missing some if it's not that accurate.
Yes, thank you.
Our next question comes from Lee Zappas. Your line is open, sir.
Could you be a little more specific about the recommended therapy for skin infections with MRSA or suspected MRSA?
Let me just repeat because I'm not sure I heard. To be a little bit more specific about what is the recommended empiric therapy?
Yes.
And I guess you're wanting me to identify, I gave a list of agents that are being used, and I can't really, I guess you're asking me to pinpoint, one of those agents, and I really can't. As I said, we really need more data from controlled clinical trials, and that data, will fortunately become available soon with this NIH-funded clinical trial.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Delaware. Your line is open.
Yes, we're just wondering if you could comment on any studies that are available regarding the survivability of either staph versus MRSA in the environment.
Okay, thank you. There are a variety of studies that show, staph can survive on various environmental surfaces for varying amounts of time, of up to weeks or even longer. It may depend on factors such as the specific type of surface, the humidity, and so forth. Nonetheless, we believe that most transmission is still from direct skin-to-skin contact. The environment may play a role in transmission, most likely with surfaces that are, heavily or repeatedly contaminated with wound drainage.
We do have another question from Mr. Opal Q. Your line is open.
Yeah, I'm an infectious disease specialist here in Hazard and in Kentucky. And it seems to me, this is an excellent presentation, first I like to say. It seems to me every single staph aureus I'm seeing now is MRSA. I just wanted to get your thoughts on MRSA in the throat, because I've had three patients who've had tonsillopharyngitis, which cultures have been positive for MRSA.
Okay, thank you. In terms of MRSA throat infections, this is not something that I've heard a lot about. I'm aware of several studies out, not specifically dealing with community-associated MRSA, that suggest that the throat may be a common site of colonization for MRSA, and recommending that when you're doing screening for colonization, that you might consider also throat cultures.
Yeah, these three patients, one had it recurrently.
Uh-huh.
The throat was not that inflamed, and I have one who's on admission right now. She's 14 years old, and she has tonsillopharyngitis, which is quite extensive with exudates, and the culture came back positive for MRSA.
It's interesting. It's not something I've really heard much about thus far. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Chuck Sepperle. Your line is open.
Yes, our question has been answered about the how long it survives in general environments. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Phyllis Stutzman. Your line is open.
I just wanted to ask a little bit more about your recommendations for the environmental surfaces. If we have people that we've tried all the other strategies and tried decolonization, and they're still passing MRSA back and forth in a family, at that point, should we try to do something about carpet and upholstered furniture?
Thank you. So thanks for giving me a chance to clarify that, because I didn't mean to say that you should ignore
the environment until you've done everything else. We do feel that cleaning environmental surfaces is important. What we do want to emphasize, though, is that cleaning should focus on surfaces that are likely to have come into contact with bare skin or, with infected skin, and that and also to, emphasize to people that keeping their infected skin covered will go a long way to avoiding contamination of environmental surfaces in the first place.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from John Harding. Your line is open.
Yes. The hospital, one of the hospitals that I work at, has a policy of using a antibacterial lotion in lieu of hand washing between patients. I'd like to ask you to comment on this and to respond in terms of what you consider to be best practice in this setting.
Well, I would refer you to our guidance on hand hygiene that's available from the Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee, which is available on our website. The use of alcohol-based hand sanitizers is considered an appropriate option as, an adjunct or as an alternative to washing with soap and water when hands are not visibly soiled. However, I would not say that that would extend to the use of antibacterial hand lotions.
It's an alcohol-based lotion, and I don't know the exact components that's in it.
Yeah, I would refer you again to the document on hand hygiene that, again, is available on our website.
Yes. But you, from what you said, I assume that you're saying that an alcohol-based lotion is acceptable in lieu of hand washing as long as...
An alcohol-based hand sanitizer.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes,
there are certain exceptions to that, and for example, those don't kill C. diff spore. So, for example, during an outbreak of C. difficile disease, they wouldn't be appropriate. But again, all the details would be available in that document.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Eileen Bradshaw. Your line is open.
Thank you, and thank you, Dr. Gorwitz, for the presentation. It was excellent. My question is about transmission of MRSA during delivery in the healthcare setting from mother to baby and then also breastfeeding.
Thanks. Those are great questions. It sounds like you may be aware, there have been a number of groups now that have looked at group B strep screening cultures, vaginal rectal screening cultures, and identified MRSA. We know that Staph aureus colonizes the vagina in about 10-15% of women of childbearing age, so that's not new, but these studies have also identified MRSA in some proportion of those women, usually around 1%, although I've seen one abstract that identified a higher prevalence. Fortunately, this doesn't appear to be translating into an increased incidence of early onset neonatal sepsis due to MRSA, although this is something definitely we're interested in tracking. But it does point out, your question does point out the need for us to reinforce good, standard infection control practices in all healthcare settings, including settings in which, there may have been less strict adherence in the past because the patients are typically, generally healthy individuals. And those would include settings such as obstetrics and normal newborn nurseries. In terms of breastfeeding, the American Academy of Pediatrics, I know, is currently working on some guidance of for management of community-associated MRSA in children. But they did, I think within the past year, put out something in AAP News addressing this issue of breastfeeding. It's the same as the guidance for breastfeeding with mastitis and breast abscess in general, and that is that mastitis is not a reason to avoid breastfeeding. If a woman has a breast abscess, she can breastfeed from the unaffected breast, and so that's MRSA doesn't change that. And I would say the same, for a woman with a history of MRSA or with an MRSA skin infection, she can still breastfeed. It's important for her, of course, to cover up the infected skin and to avoid contacting the baby directly with that infected skin.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Gwen Borlock. Your line is open.
Thank you, Ashley. Now I have two questions. One is a follow-up to the colonized mother in the OB ward and breastfeeding. The question comes up as to whether or not the infant born of the mother who is known to be colonized with MRSA, if that infant should be placed in isolation if it goes to the nursery. The other question I have then relates to molecular testing of clusters of CA MRSA cases, and is that valuable considering that you've mentioned that the USAC and its strain is pretty homogeneous, and would you get any good information out if you did pulse field gel to determine if cases are related? And if you do pulse field gel, do you need to do things like multiple enzymes in order to get more detailed information?
Thanks. Those are great questions. In terms of the newborn of a mother with a history of MRSA, we don't have any specific recommendations on that. However, I do think it would be, it's reasonable to consider, the mother and newborn, as a unit. And so, therefore, I would follow your same hospital policy for the newborn as for the mother. So if it's your hospital policy to, for example, put under contact isolations a patient with a history of MRSA, I think you could apply that to the newborn of the mother with that history as well. Your other question is about the utility of molecular testing in clusters or outbreaks, and you bring up a great point. It's true that there's, when we're talking about the community strain, so little variability that finding, indistinguishable strains doesn't in and of itself indicate a direct transmission link. And I think it points to our need to develop, more discriminatory typing methods. Increasing the number of enzymes, I believe, with pulse field, I believe, has been done, and it's not really provided much additional benefit. But it definitely does point to our need to develop more discriminatory typing methods or combinations of typing methods.
Thank you.
Our final question comes from Noelle Miller. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Gorwitz. Thank you for your presentation. I worked in a private dermatology practice setting last year where we saw a fair number of cultures positive for MRSA. Based on the culture and sensitivities, we were able to manage most of them with tetracycline, doxycycline, or mupirocin. I was curious if you know what percentage of the community-acquired MRSA is able to be managed in the outpatient or office setting.
Thank you. So it's a difficult question to answer because, most of the studies we have involve only culture-confirmed infections, and
probably still the majority of skin infections aren't cultured. The more serious infections would be more likely to be cultured. So having said that, studies that have looked, you know, specifically at culture-confirmed skin infections, I believe, you know, on the order of 10 to 25% of those patients has been hospitalized. But I would guess that that would be an overestimate based on the fact that you're more likely to obtain a culture from a more severe infection in the first place.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gorwitz, for providing our listeners with this really important information, and I want to thank our participants for joining us today. In case you didn't get a chance to ask your question, because we know quite a few of you were still waiting in line, please send our team an email at coca@cdc.gov. That's coca@cdc.gov, as we do not want to overwhelm our gracious speaker. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to the COCA website at www.emergency.cdc.gov/COCA as they come to us. Now, if you're not subscribed to the Clinician Registry listserv and you would like other notices about COCA conference calls such as this one, please go to our website and subscribe. Our website is www.emergency.cdc.gov/clinregistry. That's www.emergency.cdc.gov/CLINREGISTRY. Thank you again, Dr. Gorwitz. We really appreciate you providing our listeners with this very timely and pertinent information. And so thank you to everyone, and have a good day.
This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect at this time. Thank you.